I've got a fucking story for you.
Oh, love to hear it.
So, you know how I've been single for, like, a year and a half now?
Yeah.
So, trying to get back into dating, right? So, my mate has been, like, on my case to go to one of these singles nights. And also, you better be fucking thankful that you have your partner, because Jesus Christ, the shit I'm going through at the moment. dating sucks, I can tell you that. So my mate's been like on my case to go to the singles night, right? So I was like, okay, so you know, he says, yeah, there's one tonight, it's Thursday night, let's go. I was like, okay, yeah, sure, then whatever, I'm not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out it's an AI matchmaking night. They have these different themes, and this one is like an AI matchmaking one.
Cool.
So you turn up, you sign up, and then you like on your phone, you lead you on WhatsApp to this app, and you fill out this questionnaire, you know, type of thing.
So how many dudes did it set you up with?
So for a preference, when it comes to these sort of social situations, you know, being in bars, loud music, a lot of people, very extroverted people. Well, I don't know if you can tell. I am not that anymore.
Yes.
For the nature of, you know, being a scale modeler, you kind of tend towards being at home more.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I have a bit of a disdain for people in general. So, you know, it doesn't. It's like, oh, well, I'll see how it goes. I'm not expecting much. And boy, was I not disappointed. So anyway, so you do the match. And then there's like an hour, right? Of you're just mingling with people, having random awkward chats. There was one girl that was running around asking every single person their thought on the Charlie Kirk thing, which was weird, also hilarious. Yeah. And also it's like, yeah, we're in New Zealand. You know, wouldn't mind having a break and not listening about American shit. I barely get to read my own news. Anyway. So after about an hour, I felt like I was on a fucking reality TV show. Cause I was literally talking to this girl and then everyone's phones starts going off. Everyone gets this text, right? So I am mid sentence when she goes, oh, we got a text, and like immediately like ignored me, turned around and started walking off. Cause it like tells you, it's like, you're in this group. I'm standing there going, oh, I guess I'll go fuck myself, shall I then? Cool. mid conversation, you just put me up, fuck you as well. So we get this text and it's I'll pull it out, because my anxiety levels were already fairly high at this point. Like I had a couple of beers to try and like level off, but it was still not a fun time.
Right.
So it goes, you are in group one. It's like, okay, it's like, group one is on the upper terrace. Go and find your group. Your match is there. Your match, and it's like, your match is very self-assured. So it gives you, like, clues on who it is.
Yeah.
We go upstairs to an even smaller group, and let's face it, the smaller a group of strangers you're with, the worse the anxiety gets, you know? Oh, it is for me. Oh, Jesus Christ. The smaller the group, the worse it is. It's horrible. At least in a crowd, you can, like, you know, you blend in. So we're in this group. And then everyone's sort of milling around. Everyone's trying to figure out, ooh, who's the match? And then you get another text. And it splits you off into an even smaller group. It goes, your group is splitting up. You're in group 1.3. There are six of you in this group. Fuck me, that was the worst thing I could have read. And it says your match is in this group. So you find your even smaller group of six people, three guys, three girls. And then you go sit down somewhere and it's like a fucking reality TV show, mate. Everyone's doing the fucking speculation who it is. And it's smaller now, so it's like one of three, and two of them I was definitely not interested in. And I'm sitting there going, uh-oh, this could be bad. I am not attracted to like anyone here. And then after 15 minutes, then it goes, this is your match in the group. And yeah, luckily I matched with this fairly attractive blonde girl, but and then it was like, it gives you all these prompts of like icebreakers and all that. But Jesus Christ. If I hadn't had like a couple of beers, I would have been like, nah, I'm out of here. This is fucking weird. I don't like this. Nope. Yeah. But
yeah. Well, how did it go after that?
We chatted, but I think there was one weird thing about these single nights I've noticed is like they're like a couple of groups of friends of people who go to them often enough that they've made friends there, and they become like these like sort of group social groups within the singles night, and it's kind of like, I think you've missed the point.
Yeah.
You know, if you've been going to singles nights for the last, you know, 6 months, almost every week, I don't think you're here for the right reason. I think you're now here just to hang out with a bunch of mates at a bar.
That's what it sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's even worse because then they start, you're literally talking to someone, and then their two friends that they met in earlier ones stroll on up and interrupt your conversation. And it's like, excuse me. You know, it's like, I saw my mate was there. I saw him talking to a girl, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to interrupt him. He's,
yeah,
bro code. He's scoring here. I'm like, whereas these other ones just turn up. It's like, if I knew you guys and you were my mates, I'd tell you to fuck off. It's like, I'm talking to this girl. Piss off. Go away. Don't interrupt. But then it's like, I don't think I'll ever go back there, because the amount of gossiping they're doing about other people who had turned up to previous events and all of that kind of stuff, and then they're like, oh, I hope this person doesn't hear. It's so awkward if he was here and all of that. I'm sitting there going, okay, fuck no. Nope.
Yeah.
I cannot do this. Nope. This is shit. This is the wrong personality type for me to be around. Yeah. not a fun time.
It doesn't sound like it.
Oh, Jesus Christ. There's like, I think there's one singles night that I'll go to, and that's in a couple of weeks. But that's been hosted at the Auckland War Memorial Museum.
Oh. So then hopefully it'd be like-minded people there for you.
Yeah, bunch of nerds.
Yeah.
Oh, well. People come, people go, but one thing will be for sure, our love of the podcast and things we talk about. Shall we actually start this thing?
Sounds good to me.
All right, after that very long intro about my very, very sad life, which I hope has put you in a much more grateful position about your own life, welcome to the Micro Machines podcast. This week we are going to be talking about the B-5N, also known as the Kate, one of the most iconic Japanese World War II aircraft. But first, we're going to do our usual introductions. So, first off, you have me, Callum, coming in from New Zealand, the absolute sad sack of shit I am, talking about his failing single life.
And you have me, Clint, in Indiana. Well, apparently Callum's alone with his glass of tears. I got myself a Ice Mountain purified water.
No tears here, mate. I'm riding on two coffees right now, and heart rate is up. I'm feeling great. But this week, we are talking about one of the most iconic Japanese torpedo bombers of World War II, the B-5N Kate, world famous, possibly most famous for Battle of Midway, Pearl Harbor, one of the most iconic Japanese aircraft of World War II, and we are going to jump straight in. But before we talk about the actual Kate itself, we have to talk about how it turned up, because, of course, the Japanese aircraft industry and pre-World War II is actually quite an interesting history to start off with. They were relying on a lot of imports, but eventually, of course, before the Second World War, Japan decided to go back into its isolationist traditions, where they didn't want to rely on outside exports. They wanted to be more self-sufficient with aircraft and weapons, technology, you know, self-sufficient within itself, and of course continuing its heinous imperialistic ventures within Manchuria, Korea, stuff like that. You know, some things never change with the Japanese until, you know, the bright lights.
I know, I think they was doing pretty good up until Pearl Harbor. It's like, if they could have just continued to beat the shit out of Russia for a while, that'd been fine.
Yeah, yeah. So, in the origins, in the early days, Japan didn't actually build its own aircraft. They just imported them. That started to change in 1918 when Lieutenant Chaiki Nakajima, sorry if I butchered that first name, but I barely speak English. Nakajima left the Navy and set up his own aviation company in Ota, the Gama Prefecture, originally teaming up with Saibi, I just know how to pronounce the last name, Kawanishi. So, funnily enough, Nakajima and Kawanishi, two aircraft manufacturers, first started off teaming up. However, the two couldn't agree on how to move forward, so they split and each went to found their own companies. Nakajima mostly focused on licensed aircraft at first, but kept working on designs he hoped would win over both the Army and the Navy. Of course, like say the American Army and Navy and Air Force famously don't like each other and never get on. Imperial Japanese Navy and Army hiked that up by 10 times. It was at like just how much they hated each other. It was to the point they physically wouldn't even talk to each other in meetings, sort of things. Like it was.
Guadalcanal could have been a lot different if the Japanese Army and Navy would have just got along better.
Oh yeah, like a lot of the failing of Japan during the Second World War was a lot of internal strife that just screwed them over so much. It's ridiculous. hence why you have you'll notice a lot of say naval aircraft, Mitsubishi, and then the Army has their own preferred companies. So by 1921, Japan brought in outside expertise to speed things along. Captain Semple arrived with 30 British instructors to assess what the young Japanese Navy Air Force needed. Around the time, Sopwith designer Herbert Smith ended up at Mitsubishi and produced the Type 10 torpedo bomber, which is this one at the top right. It is a triplane, by the way.
Very nifty looking.
Yeah, very cool. Flew off carriers, by the way.
Oh.
And you can also tell that it is a biplane designed for torpedo bombing because it does not have a middle strut between the two landing gear, because that's where the torpedo sits.
Oh, yeah, it does not. And there is a torpedo slung underneath it, too.
Yeah, and it kind of looks like how the hell did that thing lift a torpedo, to be honest? Because right? Torpedoes are famously not light. Now, the Type 10 torpedo bomber, it wasn't great, but it did make it into service on the carrier Hosho in 1923. Even then, most of the Navy brass still thought battleships were the future, except for a young captain, Yamamoto, at the Kasamaguria Naval Aviation School, who was already convinced carriers and planes were the way forward. If you want some more information on that, by the way, Lions Led by Donkeys podcast episode about the Yamato goes in depth about the whole battleship versus carrier thing and who wanted what and why. It's very interesting. By the time battleships were at their peak, they're already the whole way of naval warfare had totally changed to carriers. But the Japanese didn't want to accept that. Again, even within the Navy, infighting.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the Yamato was a total money sink, material sink, waste of time that didn't actually do anything. It only fired its guns in anger once.
Yep.
Yeah.
And its sister ship, I don't think. Let's see.
Musashi. She didn't do anything as well.
She didn't do anything.
They didn't have the fuel for it. They didn't have the ammo for it, by the way. Most of the Yamato's career was actually ferrying troops.
Yep.
So progress stayed pretty slow up until the late 1920s. The general staff wasn't impressed by the underwhelming performance of early models, and many doubted naval aviation's value at all, similar to the uphill battle Billy Mitchell was fighting with the US. Still, Japan kept learning from foreign advisors like Richard Vought at Kawasaki and Herbert Petty at Mitsubishi, and by buying planes broadly to study and copy. Western observers shrugged this off, assuming the Japanese could only make weak imitations, at least until Pearl Harbor proved otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Things started changing in the 1930s, thanks largely to Yamamoto. After a stint in Washington, he came back, rose to vice admiral, and took charge of the Naval Aviation Technical Bureau. From 1931 onwards, he pushed hard for modern aircraft, better training, and updated ordnance. By 1941, the IGN had arguably the strongest and most efficient naval air force in the world. Programs like the 9-She requirement produced the legendary A6M0 fighter, the deadly D-3A Val dive bomber, the long-range land-based bombers like the G-3M Nell and the G-4M Betty. Yamamoto also pressed for a new generation of torpedo bombers to replace the underwhelming Mitsubishi B-2M, which is this one in the middle. Very nice-looking biplane.
Very.
That initially led to the Type 96 Yokosuka B-4Y, a biplane that was already obsolete by the time it entered service in 1936, down here. One thing I noticed, you see the cowling here?
Yes.
It looks very German.
Because you noticed, I was just about to say, it looks like the German, was it Avro?
It looks like the Arado AR-196, the seaplane.
Yes, that's exactly right.
As well as the Heinzel HS-123 as well. Also one of my favorite biplanes, that one. Hmm. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Recognizing this, the Navy issued the Tenchi specifications in 1935, calling for a cutting-edge torpedo bomber with much higher performance. Yeah, of course, all the brass sit there going, "We want this. We haven't made it yet, but we want this. Have fun." Only Mitsubishi and Nakajima were trusted with the task. At Nakajima, the project was led by Katsuji Nakamura's design team, marking the start of what would become one of Japan's most important wartime aircraft developments. The design development. As you can see, we still do not have a photo of the Kate because we are still getting there. The story of the B-5N began with designer Katsuji Nakamura, who set out to replace Japan's outdated carrier biplanes. The Navy's new Tenchi specifications demanded something far faster, at least 330 kilometers per hour, a speed no biplane could ever achieve. The Mitsubishi A-5M fighter already proved what a sleek monoplane could do, topping at 440 kilometers per hour. But Navy officials still worried. Could such fast machines land safely on a carrier deck? Their hopes lay in flaps, a forgotten First World War innovation being rediscovered as a way to tame high-speed aircraft on approach. Funnily enough, things like, you know, flaps were, like, considered a, like, they didn't think they needed them, or it was like this, like, sort of weird thing with the Japanese, like, speed flaps and stuff like that. Up Rex's hangar, his episode on the Oscar.
Okay.
The Oscar has these weird speed flaps to help with turn rates and stuff, and apparently they're almost, like, taboo within the fucking Admiralty and stuff like that. It was really weird. At the same time, Japanese designers were closely studying American aircraft. In 1935, the Navy imported a Northrop BT bomber, top right here. Very tubby, stubby, little chunky thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it looks great. It's very 1930s style.
Very, yes.
Which I love. I love the 1930s style aircraft. They're so weird. Which featured a retractable landing gear and a powerful engine, technology that made a big impression. The Northrop design, along with its sibling, the A-17 Shrike, which looked exactly the same, influenced several Japanese projects, including Kawasaki's Ki-32, which is down here, the middle one, and Mitsubishi's own B-5M. Douglas would later refine the concept into the TBD Devastator and the SBD Dauntless, both of which caught the attention of Horikoshi, that was a tongue tie. that one tripped me up so bad, it was like falling down a set of stairs.
I was just looking at it. I swear the letters are moving around.
It was doing dances in front of my eyes, man. I was like, nope, that's gone the wrong way. That doesn't do that. Who knows what the hell I'm saying? So, Hiro Horikoshi, who understood that Japan needed to keep pace with these cutting-edge trends. For Nakajima, the challenge was fitting all this modern technology into a workable design. His team chose the new 840 horsepower Hikari 2 radial engine, housed in a streamlined NACA cowl, and added innovations like hydraulically retractable landing gear, the first of its kind built in Japan. All the others with retractable had to be hand-cranked. Or just didn't have retractable. It was a steep learning curve, and teething problems dragged on for months. But those lessons would later prove invaluable for future projects like the famous 12-Xi program that produced the Zero. Another hurdle was the tight space inside Japanese carrier hangars. Designers had to figure out how to fold the B-5N wings neatly while keeping them strong enough for flight. Their solution was a clever rotary joint system, where the wing sections overlapped as they folded, powered by a hydraulic cylinders hidden inside. At the same time, engineers experimented with wing shapes, trailing edges, and new variable pitch propellers, gradually transforming the aircraft into a modern streamlined strike bomber. By the way, this one down here, that is one of the competitors.
That is the. I'll say it looks a lot like a Devastator.
It's actually the Mitsubishi also produced their own aircraft that was designated the B-5N, and it was a direct competitor. That's what it looks like. Still looks weird.
It does.
First flight. The prototype of Nakajima's Type K took to the skies in January 1937. For a carrier torpedo bomber, it was a revelation. Able to hit 370 kilometers per hour in level flight, faster than anything of its kind at the time. But the design was still rough around the edges. The complex wing folding mechanism wasn't ready, so ground crews had to use a manual lever to fold the wings. That sounds fun.
Mm-hmm.
The ambitious Fowler flaps were also abandoned in favor of a simpler system where the entire trailing edge pivoted. Even the variable pitch propeller proved too complicated and was replaced at the last minute with a constant speed unit. The second prototype refined the concept further. It introduced integral fuel tanks in the center wing section and swapped the engine for a 770 horsepower Hikari 3, which was easier to service and replace. The rounded cowling and short nose gave it a distinctive look compared to later bombers. Test flights quickly showed Nakajima's design outpacing its rival, Mitsubishi's entry, and the Navy moved to adopt it as the Type 97 carrier attack bomber. Mitsubishi's 10-Xi design had its strength. With its elliptical wings inspired by the Type 97 fighter, itself drawing from on Heinkel designs, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Look up the Heinkel HE-112.
Yep.
And a powerful 1,000 horsepower Kinsai engine. It could push 378 kilometers an hour, slightly faster than the Nakajima. But its fixed landing gear with bulky fairings, manual wing folding system, and generally conservative design counted against it. The Navy also knew Mitsubishi's engineers were already stretched thin, juggling work on the Type 96 fighter, the new dive bomber competition, eventually won by Aichi's D-3A Val on the right here, and the 12-Xi fighter program that would become the Zero.
Val's a really pretty aircraft, in my opinion.
It is. It is a nice aircraft, I gotta say. Who is it that does the large-scale one? Is it Border?
If it's large scale, like 135, probably.
Yeah, I really wouldn't mind. I really want one, and that it'll look awesome. In the end, the admirals chose Nakajima's more advanced and future-proof design as the fleet's standard torpedo bomber. Still, Mitsubishi's aircraft wasn't wasted. In 1937, the Navy ordered 125 of them under the designation Type 97 Model 2 Carrier Attack Bomber, codename Mavis. Although never as prominent, it served from land bases and carriers on patrol and anti-submarine missions around South China and Hainan before being phased out by 1943. So up here you have the prototype of the B5N, by the way, also known as Type K. Final design, because of course, prototype to final design, there's always a myriad of issues that they have to fix. The B5N's cockpit layout was typical of the era, with the pilot seated up front. Like most tail dragger aircraft, forward visibility on the ground was poor, made worse by the tall landing gear legs needed to clear the bulky torpedo slung underneath. Designers made sure the tail wouldn't strike the deck on takeoff or landing, and in practice, pilots were expected to have already dropped or jettisoned the torpedo before coming back on board. Something tells me you would not want to do a heavy carrier landing with a torpedo underneath.
Oh, hell no.
Your landing gear would not, it would not take that.
Oh, no.
For carrier operations, visibility mattered most during final approach. To help, the pilot's seat could be raised, allowing his eyes to sit just above the windshield frame. Ah, as you can see down here, I think they would use that as well for takeoff, I'd say.
Oh, okay. Guess I never realized that, but yeah.
you can see he's sitting a lot higher than he should be.
Yeah.
That's pretty smart, I gotta say. The cockpit was fitted with basic blind flying instruments as well, a small step towards modernity. Well, fuck me. You know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Behind him sat the navigator, who doubled as weapons officer and observer. Facing forward, he entered through a small sliding side window and had plenty to keep him busy, monitoring fuel gauges mounted above the wing tacks, assisting with navigation, and even serving as an auxiliary mechanic in flight. Boy, that boy is busy. Mm-hmm. When bombing, he could open panels in the cockpit floor and crouch over a small ledge beside the torpedo or bombs to aim the drop. Something you'll see in, say, if you watch Tora Tora Tora, you can see them practicing that where they have, and we'll talk about this later on with the equipment they had.
Uh-huh.
At the rear was the radio operator, who also manned the defensive gun, the single defensive gun, the only gun on the entire aircraft, to be honest. He faced aft, pulling the weapon up from inside the fuselage once the canopy was slid back. Early radio sets were primitive, operating on low frequencies and requiring a long trailing antenna to function reliably. Crew communication was equally basic. Instead of intercoms, they relied on old-fashioned speaking tubes, which is literally, it is a tube with a funnel on the end so you can shout down it. That's it.
Yep. A little bit more better than a string and a can.
Only just. Oxygen equipment was rarely carried. Even though the B5N could reach altitudes where it might have been useful, simplicity and weight saving always came in first in Japanese design. Also, something tells me if you're a torpedo bomber, high altitude isn't really something you need.
True.
Standard gear included inefficient life vests and the heavy fur-lined leather suits of the day, which offered warmth but little comfort. Structurally, the B5N was modern for its day. It used a single bay fuselage of all metal stress skin, mostly welded duralium. That's a weird word, that one. Built around a semi-monocoque frame with tubular sections. Early B5N1s carried a towed antenna reel, but the later B5N2 replaced it with a fixed wire antenna stretching from the cockpit to the tail. The fuselage was light and streamlined, though large wings were needed to lift heavy loads. A trade-off that added drag and reduced speed and agility. Compared to the US Navy's TBD Devastator, the Nakajima was significantly lighter, but that came at a cost. As usual with all Japanese aircraft of the time, no armor, no self-sealing fuel tanks, no real protection for its crew. The philosophy was simple. Speed was supposed to be its defense. Somehow, a B5N Kate cannot outrun a stream of 50 cows.
No.
By the way, yes. The two spar wings folded manually, the right folding beneath the left, and stowed over the cockpit with the help of auxiliary struts. Slotted flaps extended to the folding point, while fabric-covered ailerons sat outboard. Fuel tanks were built directly into the wing's center section between the spars and trim tabs, were fitted to both rudder and elevators. Landing gear was another showcase in innovation. Each main leg retracted hydraulically into the wings, turning 90 degrees to fit flush inside. They were fitted with oil dampener shock absorbers, reinforced by struts, giving the plane a surprisingly rugged ability to handle rough landings. A simple castering tail wheel and retractable rester hook rounded out their carrier gear, the hook springing downwards automatically when deployed. As you can see down here in the bottom right, that is the Kate on a carrier landing approach. The B-5N's long greenhouse canopy housed its three-man crew, pilot up front, navigator bombardier in the middle, radio operator, rear gunner in the back. Like other Japanese multi-seat aircraft, command usually rested with the observer, who directed the flight and attack. This was critical for coordinating long-range strikes across the Pacific. For bomb aiming, the navigator could open two small doors in the cockpit floor to line up his target. Very simple. Mm-hmm. The radio operator sat on a rotating stool, able to swivel around and raise his machine gun after sliding back the canopy. The layout was compact, even cramped, but functional. And outwardly, the B-5N looked sleek and modern in its first appearance. In practice, though, it fell short of its designer's hopes. With a maximum speed of about 320 kilometers an hour, it could not outrun enemy fighters. Even Chinese interceptors in the late 1930s could catch it with ease.
Not good.
No. The equipment. The navigator slash bombardier slash observer station was equipped with a Type 90 bomb sight, a vertically mounted optical tube positioned to the front left of the seat, as we can see right here.
Pretty cool looking.
Yeah. For navigation, a Type 3 reflector compass was installed on the cockpit frame, providing precise directional reference during extended overwater operations. Radio equipment was mounted directly behind the navigator's position, accessible by the radio operator slash rear gunner. The B5N1 was fitted with the Type 96 Mark III set, while the B5N2 employed the improved Type 2 Mark III set. Both units were positioned in front of the radio operator, integrated into the rear cockpit station for direct operation during flight. Armament on the early B5N1 was modest. Yeah, I wouldn't say modest. What's less than modest? Barely. Some carried a pair of fixed 7.7mm Type 97 machine guns in the wings for strafing, but many went without and relied solely on a single flexible mounted Type 92 machine gun at the rear for defense, a weapon that gave the gunner little chance against determined fighters. I think it's more of a morale boost. We can see down here in the bottom right, the Type 92 machine gun. You will notice that it looks exactly like a Lewis machine gun. And that's because it is. Yep. It is the Japanese copy of the Lewis machine gun with a few minor modifications, mainly to do with the barrel and the muzzle, but that's really about it. I think there's a few designs with like the trigger guard and stuff like that, but it's minor. But if you put them side by side, they're pretty close. The real punch came from beneath the fuselage. The B-5N was designed around the Type 91 aerial torpedo, carried on an offset rack beneath the belly. So for those building it, the torpedo is supposed to be offset from the center line.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, if you see photos, yeah, you'll notice, like even here, you can see the torpedo is slightly off, and I believe it is to the right.
It is.
Right about there. So... in practice, the aircraft could be reconfigured to carry different loads. A single 800 kg bomb, such as the Type 99 number 80 armor-piercing weapon, later used to cripple US battleships at Pearl Harbor. Two 250 kilogram bombs, or up to six smaller 60 kilogram bombs for lighter targets. The drawback was flexibility. Switching racks took about 2 hours. A costly delay that proved disastrous during the Battle of Midway, where the Japanese were caught literally halfway through rearming because the damn carrier, the admiral, couldn't decide if he wanted torpedoes or armor-piercing bombs, and kept changing his mind so often that they literally midway through changing over for, I think, like the second time or third time he changed his mind, And that's when they got caught by the Americans.
Yep.
Hence why they had flight decks absolutely loaded with aircraft and ordnance.
Just like they also, well, they had previously thought they had sunk the Yorktown, but the Yorktown had come back. They thought they sunk it again during the Battle of Midway. And then they attacked it the third time, thinking that it was a different carrier still. So, yeah.
And then it eventually was scuttled by some destroyer launch torpedoes, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yorktown did not want to go down.
No, even then it didn't want to go down easily as well.
No, it didn't.
So that's all the technical aspects of the B-5M, but we'll go into their extensive use, because they were used throughout the entirety of the war, by the way, even though the Americans changed out their aircraft, and the Japanese did introduce new aircraft, but they couldn't really afford to send things into reserve, so they had to change their job, we'll say.
Yeah.
So, famously, on December 7th, 1941, the world learned a lesson it thought it already knew. Never underestimate the enemy. The Nakajima B-5N, virtually unknown outside Japan, made its devastating debut at Pearl Harbor. Codenamed Kate by Allied intelligence, the aircraft had already seen combat in China, but it was Pearl Harbor that it cemented its place in history. By the way, for those who don't know, the Battle of Pearl Harbor, well, Pearl Harbor was actually directly influenced by the Battle at Taranto. The British Swordfish attack against Italian battleships.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone thought that you couldn't do it because it's too shallow, and then the British did, and the Japanese went, hey, that's not a bad idea. The B-5N1 first went into action in 1938 during the Second Sino-Japanese War. Flown mostly from land bases, it supported Japanese army operations around Hankow. Shortcomings were quickly noticed, but rather than add protection, the Navy demanded more speed. By 1939, the improved B-5N2 became the main production version. These aircraft operated from bases across French Indochina in 1940 under an arrangement with the Vichy government, bombing Chinese forces in the south. At the same time, naval aviation thinkers like Minoru Genda, whatever, studied the British attack at Taranto and concluded that a similar surprise strike could cripple the US Pacific Fleet. Admiral Yamamoto, you cannot say Yamamoto without adding the way, so just try it. You can't do it. Agreed, and the B-5N would be central to the plan. Special torpedoes were developed for Pearl Harbor's shallow waters, fitted with wooden tail fins to keep them from diving too deep. With armor-piercing bombs in short supply, engineers improvised, modifying 16-inch naval shells into 800-kilogram bombs with welded stabilizers. That's kind of cool. I wouldn't mind having one loaded up with that.
That would be a neat idea.
Yeah. Throughout late 1941, B-5N crews trained extensively at the Gulf of South Kyushu. The first air fleet sailed from the Kurilis in late November. Admiral Nagumo had 353 aircraft at his disposal. At dawn on December 7th, the B-5N launched in two waves. The first, led by Mitsu Fuchida, sent 50 bomb-armed B-5N2s and 40 torpedo-carrying B-5N1s against Pearl Harbor. Torpedo leader Shigeharu Murata guided his planes low across the waters at 7:49 a.m., beginning the attack. A second wave followed, including 54 more B-5Ns armed as level bombers. By 8:30, the strike was over. Over only five Kates had been lost. The results break for themselves. Nearly a third of the torpedoes and more than a quarter of the bombs scored direct hits, the payoff of months of relentless practice. Funny that.
Mm-hmm.
It's also weird to think that, you know, the entire attack started at 10 to 8, finished at 8:30. It was only 40 minutes long.
Yeah.
Unless you watch, I mean, I'm pretty sure the battle scene in the movie Pearl Harbor is longer than that.
I couldn't tell you. I know I've seen the movie before, but yeah.
I haven't seen the movie, and I still maintain that it doesn't exist, and Tora 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 is the only movie about Pearl Harbor. it's the only one you should see, to be honest.
Right.
Like, still, it is still, I've watched it at least 8 times in my life, and I still enjoy it. For the next year, the B-5N was at the heart of Japanese carrier warfare. In early 1942, they joined dive bombers in the East Indies campaign, sinking the cruisers Dorchester and Cornwall, and the carrier Hermes. At Coral Sea, B-5Ns helped sink the Lexington. At Santa Cruz, they finished off the Hornet. At Midway, their torpedo runs nearly destroyed the Yorktown, which was later sunk by a submarine. Okay, not a destroyer.
No, we tried to scuttle it, but yeah, it was still afloat.
Yeah, that bitch just didn't want to go down.
It didn't.
B-5N crews trained to work closely with the Aichi D-3A dive bombers. The Vals would dive first, drawing off anti-aircraft fire, before the slower Kates came in low for the torpedo strike. The tactic worked, until Midway. There, Japan committed its torpedo bombers without effective fighter cover, and the results were catastrophic. Half of the Navy's trained crews were lost in a single day. The losses of Akagi, Kaga, Soyuru, and Hiru sealed the fate of Japan's carrier force. After Midway, the decline was rapid. Battles in the Eastern Solomon, Santa Cruz, and Guadalcanal bled away the remaining veteran pilots. By 1943, carrier battles had all but ceased, and surviving B-5Ns operated from land bases at places like Bern and Kolumbagara. Never heard of that place.
Me either.
Increasing Allied air cover and powerful anti-aircraft fire made their missions even more costly. With the arrival of the Hellcat and the Corsair, the slow Kates were slaughtered whenever they tried to attack. By 1944, the Nakajima B-6N Tenzan, known to the Allies as Jill, was replacing the B-5N, but many of the older planes still lingered. During the Battle of the Philippine Sea, Japan lost 3 carriers and more than 1,600 aircraft, including the last large group of Kates. After that, their role shifted almost entirely to kamikaze missions. As I said before, there is no such thing as a reserve aircraft in the Japanese Air Force. They will always have something to do.
Right.
Worn-out B-5Ns, often flown by barely trained pilots. Well, they don't need much training, to be honest.
They don't need to learn to land.
Yeah. Struck at U.S. forces during Leyte Gulf, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. A few even flew from Kyushu in the final summer of 1945. From its thunderous debut at Pearl Harbor to its desperate end as a kamikaze, the B-5N had carried the weight of Japan's naval air arm. It began as the most advanced torpedo bomber in the world, but by the end of the war, it was hopelessly outclassed. The end of the Kates. The trio of carrier aircraft that struck at Pearl Harbor, the A6M20, the D3A1 Val, and the B5N2 Kate, mirrored the US Navy's F4 F-3 Wildcat, the SBD-3 Dauntless, and the TBD-1 Devastator. In 1941, the Japanese machines generally outperformed their American counterparts, the exception being the rugged and effective Dauntless. The Devastator was absolutely totally stuffed. It was a shite aircraft. Yeah. The situation for Britain's fleet air arm was worse. After years of neglect, its fulmars, skuas, and swordfish were wholly unsuited to the Civil War. By 1943, however, the balance shifted. The arrival of the F-6F Hellcat, the SB-2C Hull Diver, and the TBF Avenger relegated Japan's early trio into obsolescence. The Zero lingered on, but the B-5N2 remained in frontline use only until mid-1944. The Navy's frantic search for a successor had begun much earlier. Nakajima's B-6N1 Tenzan, also known as, translates to Heaven's Peak, which is a baller of a name, I gotta say.
Right.
Flew in March 1942, powered by the 1,870 horsepower Mamori engine. Persistent vibration problems doomed that power plant, forcing adoption of the Mitsubishi Kensai and the B-6N2 Jill. By the time it entered widespread service, the great carrier battles were already lost. In the Marianas campaign of June 1944, the Jill was present mainly as land-based aircraft. Which is also down here, by the way. That is the Tenzan or Jill. another very cool looking aircraft.
It really is.
The surviving B-5N2s were adapted for secondary roles. Some received anti-ship radar with antenna arrays mounted along the fuselage sides and wings, and were employed on anti-submarine patrols in poor weather or at night. Crews were trained to skim the surface at altitudes as low as 9 to 12 meters, releasing 283.5 kilogram bombs with delayed fuses to mimic depth charges. By 1945, the few Kates left were reduced to towing gliders and target sleeves over the home islands. A humble end for a machine that once spearheaded Japan's greatest naval victories. And as you can see right here, that is those are captured Kates showing off the anti-shipping radar antennae.
Never knew they had that role.
Yeah, right at the end. So that's the career. We'll talk about the specifics, but, you know, we also really like modeling. And, of course, what is the one thing that Japanese aircraft are very well known for, Clint? What's the main thing people like them for?
Oh, the beautiful, weathering, the stripping of the green paint to show the aluminum finish underneath.
In general, they just have really colorful schemes.
That too.
So, the colorful Kates. Pre-war finish, B-5N1 and early B-5N2. So this is what their pre-war mainly looked like. Many aircraft left the factory in overall silver and aluminium for peacetime use and the early China War period. As the Pacific War approached, this gave way to camouflage finishes. Base color at the start of the Pacific War. By late 1941, many carrier Kates carried a light gray/gray-green overall finish, often described as G3 ash gray, sometimes called AIM Iro or amber gray in older literature. So ash gray and amber gray, both the same thing. Over this base, dark green was applied to the upper surfaces. Surviving wreckage and research notes indicate this green was applied before the Pearl Harbor strike while units were ashore in Kyushu for workups, and was not always complete or even, so underside grey-green surfaces often showed through. Why the blotchy or patchy look? The upper surface green was frequently field-applied without a full primer coat and sometimes hurriedly. Combined with carrier deck wear and salt environments, this produced the irregular edges and overspray, localized chipping, and also the localized chipping that us modelers love to replicate. A note here, though, Navy finishes were generally good. The heavy flaking is often seen on late war army types and less typical for earlier war Kates. So if you're doing early war, a bit cleaner. If you're doing late war, go for it. Color standards and which green? Because this is a debate. IGN trials at Yokosuka, late 41, early 42, led to very dark green black as the preferred camouflage tone. Later orders in July 1943 formalized dark green on production aircraft. For Pearl Harbor era B-5N2s, the field applied dark green over gray and gray-green base best matches. Aviation of Japan discusses the Kariki 117 color cards and how I3J3 terms were used and misused in older sources, because of course even the professionals back then got things wrong. Things were like mixed up or not correct, recorded correctly. So yeah, that always helps when you're trying to read things and say, hey, they're saying this, but this says this and that says that.
Yeah.
Markings, tail codes, and bands, also correcting Kenji. IGN carrier aircraft used Roman letter tail codes plus numerals, e.g. AI-301 for Akagi, not Kenji. During the Pearl Harbor period, the carrier division color bands on the fuselage identified the parent ship. Card Div 1 was for the Akagi and Kaga, and that was red. Card Div 2, the Soryu and Hiryu, were blue. Carrier Division 5, the Shokaku and the Zukaku, were white, with one band for the senior ship and two for the junior. These systems and code prefixes A, AI, A2, B1, B, all of that, were well documented in contemporary summaries. The Hinemaru and outlines. Early war IJN Hinemaru were plain red. White borders around the fuselage and sometimes the wing Hinemaru became common from mid-1942 onward. And Nakajima built types first. For Pearl Harbor, Kate's no white outline was appropriate. So, all you making Kates, write this down. Oh, and also another thing, heavily chip the aircraft, but don't chip the Hinemaru. That was considered sacred, and they absolutely kept the Hinemaru painted up every time it was chipped. So the rest of it, chip away, but the Hinemaru was never chipped. And if you do see it chipped, it's usually because it's in a bloody graveyard.
Yes.
Other things, the yellow IFF wing leading edge bands. Those familiar yellow leading edge bands were a later war recognition system seen widely around 1943 onwards. So they do not belong on Pearl Harbor Kates. Weathering patterns you'll actually see in photos and relics. Upper dark green worn thin over panel centers in high traffic areas with soft uneven edges against the gray-green base where their field spray jobs ended. So if you do want to have overspray and stuff like that, that's more than fine. Because it did happen.
Yeah.
Localized chipping to metal at cowl lips, wing roots, and access panels. Heavy all over flaking is more of a late war or an army thing. So the uber heavy stuff is mainly for army. If you're doing a carrier based one, not so much. A few examples up here for any video watchers, but of course, you listeners, I'll still describe things. So, Akagi example, AI-301, Fushida's, thank you. What the photo and sources show, upper surface of a very dark green, field applied and very uneven. Lower surface was either silver, aluminium, or light ash grey. Tail with bold identification bands. Period images and prints frequently show green upper with the bright tail bands. For the upper, use very dark IJN green. Common models relevant, Gunze H36, Mr. Color Nakajima green. I didn't believe Mr. Color actually had a specific green for Nakajima. It's kind of cool.
And I didn't either.
For MRP or AK variants, labeled Ryuku Koku Shuku or black green. Lower, natural metal finish or light ash gray. Some modelers prefer a slightly warm natural metal to match photos. Weathering tips for this specific one. Spray the green thin so the metallic gray shows through in patches and panel centers. Add chipping on cowls, wing roots, and around fasteners. For Kaga, carrier Kates, what the records say, Kaga's air group used the same field reapplied dark green upper surfaces around Pearl Harbor. Undersides vary in photos between silver and light gray. Local application produced soft, irregular edges where the green met the lighter lower color. For model paint callouts, dark IJN green for tops, similarly, same family as above, lower surfaces, J3 or metal. For specific aircraft, example, the torpedo Kates, add the appropriate carrier band, Kaga bands, lesser code shown. Weathering tips, simulate overspray and uneven coverage on trailing edges and aileron hinges. Field paint jobs often didn't wrap around wing leading edges as well. Just a few more here. We've got three more. The Zukaku examples. So clear period images exist of Zukaku Kates over Pearl Harbor showing dark green uppers and lighter undersides. An identified photo of E11-307 is widely reproduced. Use these photos as the best reference for panel contrast and code placement. Model paint callouts. Course, dark green upper, Gunze H3, MRK, yada da da da, all of that. Over ash gray or polished metal. Weathering tip, in the photos, the green often thins towards the wing center panels, airbrush and graduated thin coat so the lower color peeks through. Very handy hints, these. Shikaku, general notes about the Shikaku and sister carriers. What to expect, same basic pattern, green, dark green tops over lighter undersurfaces. But local pigment mixes, application methods and aging produce visible variants. Between manufacturer batches and shipbound repainting, IGN color standards existed, but field practice varied, so you can kind of get away with a bit of green variation here.
Hmm.
Model paint callouts are the exact same for the others, but just tweak them a little bit. Lastly, for captured B5Ns, or factory silver ones. Some B5Ns showed natural metal finishes, useful for when you want the pre-war factory silver, or to represent an aircraft with heavy weathering where the green has flaked away. US tests of captured B5Ns around 1943 showed polished or metal undersides and sometimes whole airframe metal. There's also one more camouflage, and that is surrender camouflage. Of course, there was a whole bunch of Japanese aircraft that needed to surrender to Allied forces. And they were all told the aircraft needed to be painted white, the Hinamaru painted over with a green cross, I think it was.
Hmm.
That was the that was surrender markings. And there's a whole, if you look up surrender markings, there's a whole bunch of them, and they look really cool. And that was to allow the Allies to identify aircraft that was coming into airfields to surrender. So, yeah. And also you can see here a couple of examples of different cates and different modifications and paint schemes. And, yeah, very cool.
Very.
Knowing all of this, I bet you guys want to build one. So, first off, Border. Of course, with their 35th scale aircraft, they have released one. That is the Nakajima B5N2 Type 97 carrier. This comes with a full interior as well as the torpedo, as well as markings for the Akagi. For the Akagi. So you will see dark green, ash gray, red band for Akagi, all of that stuff. So this is the kit that I really want because, I really, really want this one.
Pretty neat.
And I do know someone from another podcast, James Skiffins, he's actually building, I'm not sure if he's building the Kate as well, he's doing the Zero in 35th, but it's he's actually building, he's going to scratch build a section of aircraft carrier, like three levels, and I think it's during Midway, a bomb went straight through and detonated two levels down, so he's going to be showing that, like the detonation and then all the floors up and right up to like where the bomb entered the deck and stuff like that. It's going to look really cool.
Yeah, that does sound cool.
Yeah. I think he needs something like 100 figures for it.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Up next from Airfix, they do a couple of decent kits, actually. You can either choose between the Nakajima B5N2 and the B5N1. You will also notice that because of the engine differences between the N1 and N2, there are slight cowling differences. And, of course, as part of the Airfix Club a couple of years ago, they released their limited edition kits of the Kate, one of the Technical Air Intelligence Center in 1945 with American markings, and, as I said previously, surrender markings, where you can see it is white with scratched out Hinamaru's and big green crosses on them.
Hmm.
It's also a very good kit, this one, I've been told. So if you're into Airfix, go for those. However, if you want the largest variety, also Airfix ones are in 72nd scale. So if you're a 172nd scale modeler. But if you want the largest range of different types, Hasegawa is yours to go to. They provide both in 48 scale and 72nd scale. So here is a small list of the 48 scale ones, which some of them I really wouldn't mind because they have all sorts of different modifications and all sorts of schemes and decal kits to go with. So you got a very wide choice for Hasegawa, and you generally can't go wrong with Hasegawa as well.
No, they're time tested.
Yeah, there's some that they kind of fail on, but others. So, but we have stuff here like several Pearl Harbor ones, air operations over Okinawa. So those are late war ones. So you can see the differences in all the schemes here. Pearl Harbor second wave one has these awesome white stripes on the tail and two big stripes on red stripes on the wings. Looks amazing. You got 12th Flying Group, you got Zukaku aircraft attack, all sorts. And as I said before, they also offer them in 72nd scale. The one that I really want is the limited edition B5N2 Type 97 with a Model 3. So it's the Model 3 with the 800 kilogram armor piercing bomb modified from a 16-inch shell. Which you can see right here. Looks weird, but you can buy that kit.
Hell yeah.
As well as all sorts, like a Pearl Harbor torpedo command bomber. You have Midway, you have all sorts. So, Hasegawa, if you want to build a Kate. And that's it. That's all we got for the Nakajima B5N Kate. We're just going to have a quick intermission before we get on with the rest of the episode. So, we'll be back in a moment. And we are back with the hobby news, and it's been a while, so let's have a look. And, of course, we'll be going through our rating of 1 to 10 of how exciting the release is, what we think of the subject, the everything else. So, let's crack into it. First off, we have from MiniArt, they are releasing a Kursk 1943 Panzer IV field repair party. This comes with seven figures, telegraph pole, equipment, diorama base, and the kit of the Panzer IV.
Oh, okay, now I'm interested.
So they're calling it a big set. So, yeah, has Panzer IV in it, which is the Panzer IV... G? No. H? Long barrel. It hasn't got the side skirts. It's got the it's got the Schützen on the turret. It is 1943, so it must be like an H.
Yeah, I'm gonna say it's an H.
Yeah. Either way. Either way, this would definitely be a pretty cool kit to have, because considering the amount of stuff you get, it will probably be heinously expensive, but.
Oh, I'm guessing 75 to 80 mini art.
Yeah, at least. But I know you and probably Garrison would love to have this one.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I don't like is the base. But it's like the other stuff that comes with it. Like, the looks like it comes with a good variety of tools, ladders, buckets. The telephone pole. Yeah, everything but the base. I'd want to make my own base, but...
Yeah. What do you reckon out of 10?
7 out of 10.
7 out of 10. I can agree with that. Very cool for anyone who likes to do dioramas. Fine Molds have got a new boxing of the F-14A. They're calling it the Bombcat. So it's a Tomcat with bombs.
Fine Molds make some very nice stuff.
That they do. They are well known. So... this is sort of a new boxing of an older kit, but with some added stuff. So I do like that. Even though I don't build modern stuff, I do like the Tomcat a lot. So I'll go with a 7 out of 10 for me.
Nah, it's 5 out of 10. 72nd
scale.
You say 72nd?
Yeah.
Yeah, 4 out of 10.
From T-Model, they're releasing a US M... 1025-6 HMMWV, also known as the Humvee.
Is this TACOM?
I don't know, it's a T model.
It looks very TACOM-ish.
Yeah, it kind of does. So this is an early Humvee where it's got a top-mounted 50 cal, but only with a gun shield, not the full turret. Yeah, I'm not a big Humvee guy, to be honest.
And yeah, 72nd.
In 72nd scale as well, so 4.
Yeah, four.
4 out of 10.
Or 4 out of 10 for me, yeah.
A weird one from Border in 350 scale. So they released, they did a new releasing of the Yamato. This one is the they're calling it the Imperial Japanese Navy Battleship Parallel World Yamato.
Oh, I was just looking, it's like the more I look at it, the worse it gets.
So they're doing like this sort of alternate reality where I think Japan won. So this is like the Yamato in 1965, where it's got like, you know, they upgraded the was it the Missouri or the Montana?
The Iowa class battleships.
Yeah. With modern stuff. This one, though, when you look at it, it doesn't really make sense.
No, it's got the Russian ICBM launchers on the side.
Well, it's got Russian equipment, but it's Japanese. The Japs and the Russians don't really like each other.
No, they never did.
If the Japanese had won, they still wouldn't be using Russian equipment.
No.
unless this is like a really weird parallel world where they do like each other and somehow...
It would have to be.
I don't know what's going on here. However, I would totally build this to put it into a model comp with no context just to see people getting really confused and frustrated about it.
Oh, definitely. I just realized the Golden Gate Bridge behind it.
Yep, that as well. So, and you also got that weird Russian naval helicopter that's ugly as fuck in the back here as well. This is a clusterfuck, isn't it?
Yeah.
The more you look at it, the worse it's getting.
Exactly. Did they remove the chrysanthemum off of it?
Yeah, looks like it. It's not on the back.
I know. There was one on the front and the back, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think so.
1 out of 10.
Yeah, good. I'll go 2 just because it feels like a troll.
It is. Was this like an April Fool's release or?
I don't know. It's recent. Okay, from Armor Hobby in 48 scale, we are getting a brand new Hurricane Mark 1. So this will come with markings for the black and white underside Mark 1s. I'm not sure if they give the option for having a twin or three-bladed prop, so hopefully they do. However, I really want this. 48 scale Mark 1 Hurricane, hell yeah. This is about an 8 for me. Also, I really want to build an Armor Hobby Hurricane because they're supposed to be really good.
I'll give it a 6 since I put it into a proper scale.
This one I was showing off to you guys from Masterbox. They're calling it Hot Summer 1941 German Infantry World War II era. Basically, you're getting about 5 German soldiers from 1941. And they're kind of just having a casual stroll on the Eastern Front. Generally not looking like they're having a fun time, but I am led to believe the Germans didn't really have much of a fun time. Especially on the Eastern Front.
Oh, yeah. I'll give it a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I'll go 6 out of 10. It's like sort of rear echelon type stuff, you know, not in battle sort of thing, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Up next,
what the fuck is that?
In Hobby Boss, in 1350 scale, we get an HMS General Wolf, which is a sister ship to an earlier monitor that they released. These monitors were for coastal defense and shore bombardment. Originally, they were fitted with very old vintage 12-inch guns, and then they decided, it's not quite enough, so they're going to slap on a 16-inch gun on the back. They are ugly as sin, and I want one so bad because they're also so cool.
I was about to say, this looks like some sort of like early Civil War, like ironclad or something, but yeah, I want to build one. 7 out of 10.
Yeah, 7 out of 10 for me. Just because I don't know how Hobby Boss ships build up like.
If it's anything else like Hobby Boss, then it build up like shit.
Another one from Fine Molds in 72nd scale. We are getting an F-104J, which is the Japanese variant of the F-104. Brand new tooling, so you know it would be an amazing kit to put together. It's a cool aircraft. Go with 7 out of 10 for this one.
Scale?
72nd.
6 out of 10.
TACOM, bringing out new tooled and new parts for their 48 scale Panther G, I think it is.
Yeah, it looks like a G.
Yeah. So 48 scale for all of you into quarter scale stuff. For me, nope, not into that kind of thing. But because I don't even think you build 48 scale armor, do you? You only do aircraft.
Yeah, just aircraft and that scale.
I think 48 armor is weird. It's a weird sort of scale.
It is, but I can understand it for people who want to mix aircraft and armor. Yeah. Just like the 135th scale aircraft from Border, I can see the niche. It's just not for me.
Yeah, I mean, if you also haven't got a lot of space as well, then it makes sense. But
oh yeah,
I prefer 35th.
I mean, it's honestly it's a good mix. You know, if you want something bigger than 72nd or 76 in armor, then yeah, it's a good alternative.
Yeah, I'll go 6 out of 10.
5 out of 10 for me.
Another one from Mini Art as part of their SDKFZ 234 series. They're bringing out the 234-4 with a crew, and that is the Puma with the 7.5 centimeter anti tank gun on it, with the open top as well.
Yes.
So this includes 4 decal options. Does come with a crew of 4. Full interior and all of that, so I figured you, Clint, would definitely be into this one.
Actually, oh yeah,
it's got 5 crew.
This is the only one I don't have, because I got I've built 2 of these so far, both Dragon, the 234, but not I haven't built the /4, and I got the /2 by Mini Art in the stash. So yes, I would definitely be wanting this one.
Which one's the /2?
That's just the normal Puma.
Okay, yep, yeah. Which is the one that's got the stubby 75 on it?
I built that one too. I built that one at AFE Club. Is that the 3?
Yeah. I think so, yeah. I really want the 3 and the 4. I think they look the best.
Yeah. But yeah, I built 3 of these so far.
Yeah, I wonder how the Mini Art ones build up. I'm sure they'll be complicated as hell, but...
Oh, they look good. They can't be much harder or any harder than the Dragon.
Yeah, hopefully with better instructions. What are you going to give this out of a 10?
Oh, I definitely want this. I give this 9 out of 10.
Shocking. Yeah, I'll go 9 out of 10 as well. I've seen them build up and they look really cool. Getting a new boxing for the Fine Molds Imperial Japanese Army Tankette, the Type 97T Key. They are absolutely adorable, and I think this is one of the ones I got to stand next to at Canberra in the museum last year, and it is beyond tiny. I think it comes up to my chest, like the top of the turret.
There is one at the Indiana Military Museum that is on loan from the Marine Corps, and it is sitting as is. All the panels have been welded shut on it because apparently there are still Japanese remains inside and all the asbestos.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Bet it smells great in there.
Well, I mean, it's, what, 80 years old? It's like there's no more smell.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious. I'd be curious to know what remains they're talking about.
All I know is the curator's like, when we received it from the Marine Corps, it was all welded up, and they explicit instructions not to open any panels because there were still remains and asbestos inside of it.
Makes you wonder how it was knocked out then.
Well, there is a hole that has been patched over.
Oh, how big is said hole?
Probably about the size of a fist.
So most likely a 37mm or a bazooka, you reckon then? Because if it was a 75, probably. That thing wouldn't even be like on this realm.
Oh no, it was. My guess would probably be a bazooka.
Yeah. However, this fine molds one does not come with burned up insides, and it is in 35th scale as well. So I would really, really love to have one of these.
Oh yeah,
8 out of 10.
8 out of 10. I agree with you.
A couple more from fine molds. These are in. Actually, I've got to double check this because I got the scale wrong. But they're offering
the cherry blossoms.
Yeah. The Imperial Japanese Navy Yokosuka MXY7 Oka,
or the cherry blossom, or I think it was also known as the Baka or Fool.
Hmm.
So you get two kits. They've got two kits, one of the full production type and one of the unpowered trainer set. This one comes with, you know, landing gear in the form of a kid, which I'm sure would be terrifying to land in, I gotta say.
Oh, yeah.
This one, however, if I scroll down enough, because I've totally forgotten what scale they are in. I have a feeling they're in 72nd scale, which would be absolutely tiny.
Oh, yeah. I don't... Someplace makes these in 48. I was thinking it was fine molds.
Bren gun.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
there you are.
These ones are also in 48 scale as well.
Yeah, I would love to have one. I'd give it 7 out of 10. Which, of course, if you ever get to the Museum of the United States Army Air Force, it's like they have one of these that they captured sitting right next to their restored Black Widow.
Yeah, nice. I think the RAF Museum in Hendon has one of these as well. But, yeah. Although, if I was to build one of these, I'd want it slung under the Betty Bomber as well.
Oh, that would be cool, yeah. Try to do an in-flight setup with it.
Yeah, yeah. I'll go 7 out of 10 for this.
Yeah, 7 out of 10.
And lastly, from AFV Club, they are bringing out an Australian Army M113A1 LRV with the Dihill 513B track. So this is an Australian modification of the M13, a fairly new one. And, yeah.
I mean, the Australian stuff, I mean, I have to say it's a complete lack in the hobby, it seems like.
Yeah, AV Club have brought out a couple of Australian M113s. The only real other thing that you can get is the ASLAV, the Australian LAV, as well as the M1 Abrams, which you need to buy an Australian conversion kit for. So, yeah. I would say it's like, why can't there be any more New Zealand stuff? But there isn't much in the way of New Zealand stuff. Although, we are getting MH-60 Seahawks as replacement aircraft helicopters, so I really wouldn't mind. I just need to wait to see how they paint them up and scheme them. It's going to be in that horrible, horrible grey that we use in low vis, but at the same time, I really wouldn't mind it just because it's something new. I really hope someone does like a decal set for it or something like that when they come out.
Yeah. Now, I don't know much about Australia, but what is that in the background?
What, that?
No, the statue balancing on a ball.
I think this is when they're deployed overseas somewhere. I am trying to remember because I don't think that's an Australian thing.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, just go 7 out of 10 for this.
Yeah, 5 out of 10 for me.
I mean, the M113 isn't exactly the most exciting vehicle in the world. I do like the 50 cal and commander's turret it's got. So.
Oh yeah, that's pretty nifty.
The Australians did like to put a turret on an M113. They've done it a few times. And that's it. That's all for now for hobby news. Next up, we're going to just do a quick overview of what we've been working on for the last month or so, because it has been a while since we've recorded.
It has been a while.
And up first is you. Take it away.
I've been working on my accurate miniatures Avenger here. I got all the painting done, and now I'm going to start the decals sometime tonight. It's going to be a New Zealand bird.
Which I managed to convince him to do. Yes. You're doing the one with the decal of the Kiwi that's got wings taped to it, aren't you?
Yes, it says that. Who says that bitch can't fly?
Yeah, that one. That one. Yeah. I love that one. Well, you only got a couple of weeks left, I think.
Oh yeah. I should have this done. I mean, I've been having more time to work on it this past week. Because of the weather, and it's supposed to be rainy again next week, so that'll keep me inside, so.
Yeah, fair enough. And I know you had a few issues with this one and losing a window for a while, didn't you?
Yes, I can't remember which one. I lost a window, end up binding it again, stuck to the backside of the masking that I had put down over the radio operator's compartment. I lost something for like a good 20 minutes too. I can't remember what it was. And then the other day when I was getting ready for paint and I was putting the packing foam into the pilot's area, it's like I heard something go crunch and I pulled the packing foam out to realize that the gun sight had broken off.
Ooh.
Yeah, so... Yeah, it should be easy fix.
Yeah, hopefully.
It's just like, I don't want to deal with that now to put the packing foam back in.
fair enough.
But build-wise, though, I mean, accurate miniatures, I mean, they was very well ahead of their time.
Yeah, they look like really good kits. I can't wait to start my B25D that I've got. That'll be really. That's going to be a great kit, but I've got a few paints that I need to buy for that one. So, yeah, nice. that's gonna be a holiday build, you know, because I got at the end of the year, I have about 3 weeks off work. So,
yeah,
primarily what I'll be doing for 3 weeks.
Yeah, I got that kit in the stash too, but mine's not the accurate miniature. It's a Revel Rebox, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Well, if it's a Rebox of the accurate miniatures one, then yeah, it's going to be it'll be a good kit. Up next, two from me. So first off is my entry for our naval aircraft group build. This is the Hobby Boss Seahawk, the FGA-6 variant. Okay, and I've done this as the one of the Seahawks from HMS Albion during the Suez Canal crisis, hence why the invasion stripes are yellow and black.
Oh, I was wondering about that.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently yellow and black invasion stripes were Suez Canal. I also chose this one because the underside is sky, not white, because painting full white underneath is a total pain in the nuts.
Yeah, I agree. I just went through that.
So, overall, it's a fairly decent kit, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think you have the whole thing built up in about a weekend, and painting it's fairly easy as well.
And why don't you tell us about the beautiful rockets on there?
So those rockets under there, the kit ones they provide are single rack and two part. So they're
two part, and you have a key system for it, and they don't fit that well. Massive seam lines. The amount of sanding you'd have to do is just not worth the effort. So instead, I jumped onto Tinkercad and designed these dual rack ones, because. Something you do see a lot of in photos is they do have these dual rack rocket launchers. So I figured I'd go for them because they just look a lot better.
Yeah, they do.
And if you want to buy them on my Colt's 3D profile, just search Columbus Models. You will find them there on sale as well for yourself. They are scaled to 72nd scale. But you can scale them upwards as well and modify them if you want to make them fit. Because, of course, they're sort of fit to a sort of generic size, you know, because different aircraft had different connection points, stuff like that. So they're kind of, they're a bit of a generic shape, but they're good enough in detail.
Yeah.
And lastly, for me, I've been working on a little modification project, conversion. Backstory is I had two Tamiya M8 Scott kits,
and I was wondering what to do with them.
And I thought maybe I'll do one as Pacific, one as European. And then I decided, nah, screw that. I'm going to convert one into an M8A1 prototype. There was a time when they were trying to look for, trying to make tank destroyers, and they figured they might be able to turn an M8 Scott howitzer motor carrier into a gun motor carrier with an M3 75mm cannon. So all the modifications have been scratch built based off photos. And there are about 8 major modifications you need to do to turn it into an M8A1. And all of this is based off two reference photos for general shape. So you need to do stuff like cut off the front fenders off the front because they were flush. You don't add side skirts because the prototype didn't need them. You'll see these two prominent weld marks, weld seams. You don't see those on production vehicles, but on this prototype, you do see these massive ungainly welds, which thankfully they do add a bit more detail. So I made those, as well as you have this weird pattern of 6 bolts on either side in the rear. And that is not on production as well, but on the prototype, they are, and they're quite visible. So I had actually made bolts, bolt heads to add on. So that's, of course, you got the main cannon. So you got to add a Sherman short 75 gun barrel onto it. So you have to modify that a bit. And also the other major thing I did was the cannon breech. So the kit comes with the M1 howitzer, the field gun.
Mm-hmm.
However, that has a totally different breech to the M3 cannon. And I was kind of thinking, I thought I could get away with it, but then I decided, nah, I'm trying to make this one as accurate to the prototype photos as possible. I have to change it, right? So I couldn't find any STL or aftermarket or anything for the cannon breech, so I designed one in Tinkercad and printed it off myself. Still got a few tweaks. I'm planning on selling it on Colts as well, but I still need to do a few tweaks on it. But for the purposes of my model, it worked out fine. All I did was I did add a tarp over the front of it where it joins onto the recoil system of the howitzer. because they ended up being a bit of a seam line there, then it just looked a bit weird. So I put a tarp over to hide it, because that's what tarps are there for.
Exactly.
and the only other major modification I did to the kit was the rubber band tracks were horrendous and wrong design and bad and, you know, to me a 70s.
Enough said.
So I managed to find a set of AFV Club T16 workable tracks. So bought them on sale, and they're only like $17 New Zealand. So I bought them. So I've actually sunk a bit more money into this than I thought I would. But overall, it's actually working out fairly well. You can see the tracks here are a little bit weird. That's just because they're not even glued down. They're all just clipped together. So they need to be like posed properly. But
yeah,
I will be making a base for this, showing it during trials. So modified the figure to hold a clipboard, and it's going to have a bit of equipment around. So it looks like they're like, you know, getting it out to prepare it for a day of prototype testing, you know, driving around and testing the gun and stuff like that. So that's what I'm going for, is the M8A1 prototype at Fort Hood in 1942-43, undergoing through trials. So
yeah.
So the other modifications you need to do is mainly with the turret outside. You need to grind back all the detail for where the grousers clip on and handles and stuff like that. And weirdly, you need to add on there, you can see these two rails. There's a rail on either side, but they're not like handheld. They're kind of just like this thing. Almost looks like a massive weld rod. I don't know, something.
I was going to say, is it like a rain gutter? But that wouldn't make any sense why we would need it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they are, but it's present in the photos, so you kind of need to make them. So, yeah, so this is now, Tamiya MH Scott is now Tamiya / Dragon, because it's got a Dragon gun barrel / AFV Club M8A1.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, and got to say, kind of proud of how this one's turning out so far. It's looking really nice.
It is looking really nice.
And it is the most modifications I've done on a single kit as well. So I was actually really enjoying doing that, because I'm sitting there going, well, if it doesn't work out or I screw it up, I've got two kits, so I don't care too much, and I didn't pay for this one. So yeah. So it's been fun. You kind of just let loose and relax and just go with the flow.
Yeah.
And just a reminder, we have a couple of weeks left of the naval aircraft build. So Clint needs to get a move on. I know a few other people, but we are starting to get a few submissions in. So if you have started to complete your builds, you can start posting photos on our Facebook page, on our Discord. You can also tag, don't forget to tag the Instagram account if you post some photos there, plus send us the photos as well, just so we can use them for judging. So if you have any questions, just try and get a hold of us. We can sort it out for you. So you have a couple of weeks left. If you do run over the time a bit, depending on when we decide to do judging, we can give you a bit of a grace for it if you really plead and promise with us. But yeah, so Naval Aircraft Group Build is wrapping up shortly, so going to move on with you lot. And that is the episode. But however, before we finish the episode, as usual, we have to give a big Patreon supporter shout out to our Pinju supporters and followers. So our Pinju supporters, Paul Gallagher, Lord Flakey, Robert Judson, Brel Mastroni, and Liam Barnett, as well as our Pinju followers, Robert Brisbane and Frank Little. You guys are amazing. You keep things going on here and you show support for our podcast. I do know it's been a while since our last recording. Again, this year has been a bit of a slow one in the old recording side of things, but don't worry, we are still active. We are still working on some things. I know Garrison has just released something pretty cool, which we'll let him talk about in the next episode, I think, when he's on.
Yeah.
I would have bought one, except I've kind of got a couple of flights. Three flights that I've been saving up for that I've been booking and trips, so I'm a bit low on money at the moment.
Ooh.
Because I'm heading down to, for all you New Zealand listeners, for mid-October, I will be down in Wellington for the New Zealand IPMS National competition. So if you're from New Zealand and you're listening in and you happen to find me, say hello. As well as I will be at Scale ACT in Canberra in November. So, yeah. Those are my main things.
Yeah.
Otherwise, with all of that done and said, we would like to thank you. If you have been listening and or watching for this long, thank you for listening and watching the Micro Machines podcast. We will see you guys in the next episode. Bye for now.
See ya.